Welcome, everyone. This is the eighth and final office hours session for the Mises Academy online class, Basics of Economics, Introduction to the Free Market. We've gone through, at this point, the first two main chunks of Lessons for the Young Economist. I mean, the book is broken up into more individual parts, but in terms of how it corresponds to the courses we're doing here at Mises Academy, it's the first two chunks where we went over the fundamentals, and then we just finished with this week's lecture going over the stock market and then also the labor theory of value, which is kind of a bonus because David Gordon's textbook talks about that. Okay, so let's jump right into the questions here. One last housekeeping thing. I still cannot with 100% confidence tell you when the next classes. We don't want it to wait too long. We want it to take about a month break is what we're shooting for, but we can't. That's not totally nailed down yet, so that's why I'm not telling you. Okay, Kim Alexander says, "What is the reasoning behind our government borrowing money from the Fed? Why can't the Treasury just print the money?" Okay, that's a great question. And so for those who want to, I'll go ahead and finish the train of thought just so you guys know, but I was going to point Kim and anyone else interested in this question to the debate that I had with Bill Still. So if you go to YouTube and just type in Robert Murphy Bill Still debate, and his name is spelled like you would expect, it was in Long Island. If you want to make sure you're looking at the right thing. And because he is a modern version of what could be called a greenbacker. And so, Kim, that's exactly what his position is. He thinks that's nuts. And you find other people like that today as well. So let me just give the quick context of it, and then I'll try to step back and answer the actual question. Okay, and in the comments, Malcolm is posting a link to the YouTube debate. Why I hesitated, though, when I brought that up is actually he and I don't really get into that too much. I mean, that's what I was trying to talk about, and that's what the debate was supposed to be about. But if you look at it, I actually think what happened is the moderator kind of threw us a question out there, which was provocative, but then it turned the debate into anarchism versus minarchism, and which was fine to have, and I was, you know, fine to do that, but it kind of distracted me. I don't think I talked to people in the audience afterwards, and I said, "Do you know that Bill Still wants to give the printing press to the Treasury?" And you know, these young guys were kind of shocked. Really, I had no idea. And you know, one would not have known from what he said in the debate that was actually Bill Still's position. Okay, but anyway. So where these greenbackers are coming from, and that term, by the way, goes back because during the Civil War, or the War Between the States, or the War of Northern Aggression, depending on which you sympathize with one side or the other, the Lincoln administration at one point just started issuing what they called greenbacks. Okay, so they suspended, because the U.S. was not on fiat currency totally until 1971, and that pseudo in 1933. But earlier, like during the Civil War, for example, there was a period where they suspended convertibility, and there were other examples where they would relieve banks from their obligations and so on. So it was not it wasn't as if the US dollar was fully upon demand, redeemable in precious metals up until 1933. That's not what happened. Okay, and so one example would be these greenbacks that were an example of fiat money. Okay, and so that's where the name, that's where we get the label for modern exponents of this view. Okay, so where Still's coming from, just real briefly, is that he, if you listen to him critique the Federal Reserve, it would sound, at least in large part, much as if you listen to me critique the Federal Reserve. And that's why I said the people in the audience, I think they didn't didn't understand what his proposal was, because he spent all his time explaining to everyone how much he hated these private sector bankers who were in cahoots with the government. So, you know, it's very easy to get an audience to be suspicious and to not like the Federal Reserve and to not like even the private sector bankers who are getting bailed out by the Fed and have a cozy relationship. And so in particular, what these people object to, or a lot of these people object to, is what Kim has put her finger on here, that it's kind of crazy when you think through exactly what's going on. But the federal government, so make sure you guys keep these terms separate. And obviously, this is not for this particular class. This is just because it was raised in office hours. So you don't need to know these distinctions for this class, but it's pretty important if you want to be a well-rounded member of the human race and also be equipped to understand what's going on with monetary policy. So in Western nations, there is, at least theoretically, this dividing line between the federal or the central government on the one hand that engages in what's called fiscal policy, so taxing and spending, versus the central bank, you know, the European Central Bank or the ECB for the Eurozone area, the Bank of England for Great Britain, the Bank of Japan, and then, of course, the Federal Reserve for the United States, Bank of Canada, what have you. All right, so in principle, the central banks are supposed to be independent from the central government or the federal government. And the reason for that is they don't want the government to just be what's called monetizing the deficit. So they don't want it to just be that, oh, gee, the government wants to spend more than it can take in tax revenue, and so it turns to the printing press, and that's the way it covers its bills. That's supposed to be a bad thing, and that's the reason for this alleged independence. And I keep saying alleged and putting my, you know, doing quotation marks and whatever, because in practice, I don't think it is independent, right? So in the United States, so from 2008 onward, just as the government wanted to start running huge budget deficits, that's the same time when the Federal Reserve started creating new money out of thin air to buy a lot of treasury bonds. And so, that's kind of convenient that right when Uncle Sam wants to issue a bunch more debt, that's when Ben Bernanke decided it would be a good time for the Federal Reserve to start buying a bunch more of Uncle Sam's debt. Okay, so when you step back and look at the big picture, and not just from 2008 onward, but just in general, the way this system works, the U.S. federal government cannot print money. Well, in general, that's not where most of our money comes from. There's like technicalities. The Treasury can do certain things. But, and, you know, there's that trillion-dollar platinum coin and all that. But generally speaking, the federal government right now is not the institution that creates new U.S. dollars. That has been outsourced to the Federal Reserve. So when the U.S. federal government runs the budget deficit, they have to get that money from somewhere. Just as a corporation, if it wants to spend more in a given fiscal year than it takes in revenues, it can't just say, oh, let's just create a bunch of $100 bills. Well, they don't have the legal power to do that. They have to issue bonds. They have to borrow the money, or they could issue equity, like we talked about this week. Okay, so same thing. So when the U.S. government runs a deficit, and that's being reported in the media, that the deficit this year is $370 billion, such and such percent of GDP, what that means is they're issuing treasury. IOUs from Uncle Sam, from the federal government, saying, if you give us money now, we will pay you interest and then give you the principal back after some time, depending on the maturity of the treasury security. Okay, but at the same time, the Federal Reserve is out there buying assets, and so it might go up to some dealer of securities and say, hey, we want to buy $1 billion worth of treasury securities from you. The dealer would say, oh, we have some. back on the shelf, as it were. Okay. And so the Federal Reserve writes a check for $1 billion, gives it to that financial institution. The financial institution gives the $1 billion worth of U.S. treasuries to the Fed. Now the Fed has that on their asset side, their balance sheet. And that financial institution, the private sector dealer in securities that maybe went to the original auction and got the bonds from the U.S. government, now has a check from the Federal Reserve for $1 billion. So what's it going to do? It's going to go to its commercial bank, its checking account, say, here, I'm making a deposit. And so then the Fed on its computers credits that commercial bank with $1 billion more in reserves. So ultimately, when you say, where did the Federal Reserve get the $1 billion to go into the market and the secondhand market, the secondary market, and buy up $1 billion of previously issued treasury securities? The answer is the Fed just created the money out of thin air. It's a computer transaction. Okay, so everyone's with me so far. So effectively what's happened there, if you cut out the middleman, so the Federal Reserve can't directly buy it from the Treasury. There's got to be a middleman. Okay, but if you cut the middleman out and just think about it, what happened is the U.S. federal government wanted to spend $1 billion more than it took in revenues from taxes and other kind of fees and stuff that the federal government can use to earn money. And so to get that extra $1 billion, it issued IOUs, treasury securities. And then the Federal Reserve bought those $1 billion worth and gave $1 billion in cash to, or the electronic, you know, bank reserves. So ultimately the Fed's checking account balance, they went up by $1 billion, so they can go spend that money just by creating it. It's a ledger entry. Now, as time passes, what happens? Well, the federal government owes interest payments on all the outstanding treasury securities that it has issued to whomever the holder is. And so the Federal Reserve happens to own a heck of a lot of treasury securities. So that means when they talk about the U.S. taxpayer having to pay a lot just to service the debt, to pay interest on the national debt, well, a lot of that money is flowing to the Federal Reserve because they happen to be sitting on a lot of the national debt. Okay, so that strikes people as insane, that the reason the Federal Reserve can create money and has a monopoly on that process is that the federal government granted them that power. Right? Because ultimately, I mean, whether you think it's good or bad, ultimately, legally, the U.S. government obviously is the ultimate arbiter in terms of who can create new dollars at all. And they have, you know, back in 1913, they ceded that power to the Federal Reserve. And that relationship has changed over time, of course. But the point is, they gave this special privilege to the Federal Reserve, and so now we're in this weird position where the Federal Reserve can create money out of thin air to then effectively lend to the federal government so that taxpayers can pay interest to the Fed on money it created out of thin air to then lend to the government. Okay, so that's everything I just said is true. Now, different people would give it different spins. But what I just said is a correct way of describing what happened. So you can see a lot of people, when they hear that, they flip out and they say, that's insane. Instead of doing that, you know, so that still causes price inflation, right? That new money is still being created when the Fed does that. So they're going to say, instead of doing that, let's cut the Fed out of it and just have the Treasury, when it needs to run a budget deficit, instead of borrowing it from somebody, from some private bankers, so we owe them interest, let's just go ahead and create that money. Because that money is going to be created anyway. So it's, you know, the amount the prices are going to go up, it's still going to happen. That's the idea. So as much as I don't like the Federal Reserve and that system, I think what the Greenbackers are proposing would be possibly be even worse. And for sure, if we're going to go ahead and reform the system and try to educate the public, I don't want to give Bill Still's solution front and center attention. Is it like, well, that's a step in the right direction? I'm not sure that it even is a step in the right direction, let alone is it the destination where we want to end up. Okay, so I don't want to take too much more time on this one question, but the problem is with that whole, with doing it that way is, look, there was a reason, a smart reason, that in theory central banks are supposed to be independent from the government, because using the printing press to cover deficits, that's what happens historically when currencies collapse. That's why. It's not that the government was just sitting around one day and said, hey, you know what, why don't we just wreck our currency and have hyperinflation? That's not what happens. That they get behind the eight ball, as it were, because they have probably, usually because they have horrible other policies, and then they just go down a vicious cycle where they start printing money to cover their deficits, and that starts causing prices to rise. And so then if they want to keep spending money for the military or social assistance programs or whatever they're doing, the prices of that stuff just keep escalating. So they keep printing more and more money to try to stay ahead of the curve, and then that just makes it worse and worse until finally, once the public starts seeing prices rise at ever-increasing rates, after a while, their expectations just take over, and then that you can't stop it, and the currency crashes. All right, so that's, in terms of the political economy, that's why you would want to have a so-called independent central bank. Just like you'd want to have freedom of the press or something, you would not want, a better example would be divided government, just like in principle in the United States, the Supreme Court can strike down laws that have been correctly passed through the normal, how does a bill become a law and stuff. The Supreme Court can come in and say, wait, that's unconstitutional. Or, you get the idea, right? So that just for the same rationale for all those checks and balances and so forth, that's also the rationale for why you want the central bank to be independent. And why there's all kinds of things about how the appointments are a certain length and that sort of thing. You don't want it to be a real political entity. Okay. Again, I think that that's a farce. I think it is political, but in principle, it's supposed to not be, because you don't want the Fed monetizing the deficit. You don't want the Fed creating more money just to satisfy the fiscal needs of the government, because think about it this way. Would you want your next door neighbor to have a printing press? You have to say, okay, here you go, Jim. Here's a printing press. If you want to go buy a Ferrari, you can do it. You can just print off $100 bills, and they're legal tender. No one's going to accuse you of counterfeiting. But, Jim, don't print too much, because if you think about it, the more you print, it effectively just takes resources from everybody else. You get that new Ferrari. It's not that you work for it. It's just you're printing off $100 bills, and so you're effectively just stealing from everyone else. And so just try not to go overboard with that printing press we're getting. Right. Would you feel comfortable with that situation? I wouldn't. And so then the question is, would you feel comfortable giving a printing press to Boehner and Nancy Pelosi? Saying, now, guys, I know there's a lot of stuff you want to spend money on, but just keep in mind, the more dollars you create, the more price inflation there's going to be. So just go easy on that. I mean, that sounds like a recipe for disaster. Okay. So good question, Kim. Let's move on here. Malcolm says, if economics is a subset of praxeology, what are all the other subsets of praxeology? While there are differing views about this in the Austrian school, what reading would you recommend that lays out all the subsets of praxeology? And then what components of libertarian Austrian philosophy that are not subsets? What are the other components besides praxeology? Okay. I'm trying to think. Well, one thing, Malcolm, this is not my area of expertise. This is more philosophical rather than economics per se. So I'm just trying to think of the best place for you to go. I'm pretty sure in Power and Market, Rothbard in the beginning talks about this stuff. Because that's so in terms of Malcolm Powell, who should I ask? Ask David Gordon. Because for one thing, he'll answer you. He's pretty good about answering email, but also he would certainly know. He could list probably just everything that's been written on this topic. But for those who are hearing me and aren't going to go email Gordon, I'm almost positive that Rothbard in the beginning of Power and Market. So Power and Market is now in the way that the Mises Institute publishes it, it's like after Man, Economy, and State, but there is a single volume, like a huge book, because that's the way he originally wrote it. But then I guess the publishers and when the thing came out in 1962, they thought it was too big, and also the Power Market was too radical, and so they, I think, convinced him just to do what we think of now as Man, Economy, and State. But originally he wrote what we now call Power and Market. It was all a big thing. But I'm pretty sure in the beginning of Power and Market, he walks through that, Malcolm, about, you know, this is what praxeology is in principle. And that's actually that's what Rothbard's trying to do, actually, there, is, you know, do a praxeological analysis of interventionism in Power and Market. So I know there have been people that have tried, like have done one-off papers on, like, a praxeological analysis of war and stuff like that. But I don't, for one thing, I can't remember who did that. And for another, I don't know whether that was well received or people thought, no, that's, you're not doing it right. So that's, I wouldn't want to push you towards those things. But if you email David Gordon, he'll know for sure. Okay, Malcolm says, I asked a question a couple weeks ago about the Mises Hayek calculation argument versus the knowledge argument and why Hayek received the Nobel instead of Mises. This lecture series by Holzman on his biography of Mises will inform on these issues and others. Okay, and then Malcolm posts a URL. Okay, and then he also follows up with Rothbard's lecture series on the history of economic thought and gives the citation there. Okay, here we go. Malcolm says, are there any other factors that lead to an increase of productivity due to the division of labor besides the ones you listed, which were switching time, automation, economies of scale, natural aptitude, and practice? Okay, so for the people who don't know what we talk about, in the textbook, Lessons from an Economist, earlier we had talked about the division of labor and you know, why Mises and other Misesians following in his wake have placed a lot of emphasis on that. Indeed, have argued that that's sort of the underpinning of modern civilization. And the fundamental empirical fact, according to Mises, and this is what people grasp with their reason, and that was the reasons for social bonds, is that human labor's productivity gets greatly amplified under the division of labor. And so that's why you want to cooperate with people. You realize working together, both of you can end up with more stuff. And Mises thinks that's the reason we have social norms and things like that, that it's it's not that the reason we're nice to each other is just because that's inborn in us, and then, oh, it's a happy offshoot. It's also more productive. Mises thinks it's the other way around, that the reason we think it's proper and just to cooperate with people and not slaughter them is ultimately a practical consideration. But that's the underpinning of it. Okay, Malcolm, so in the book, I listed a bunch of reasons to try to help the reader understand why should it be the case that the division of labor amplifies productivity. And so now Malcolm is asking me, is there any other type of explanation or factor involved that wouldn't be covered in the five things that I mentioned. Well, let me just give you one example, Malcolm, and it's just to make sure you understand. So for number four, natural aptitude, it depends. I don't have the book in front of me, so I can't remember how exactly I described it, but just want to make sure there's no confusion. It depends on what you mean by that. Because a lot of people for natural aptitude, they would think that it would just refer to the physical body of the person. All right, so, because then number four, natural aptitude, goes hand in hand with number five, practice, practice, practice. So when you want to understand, why do we get more food and clothing when we let some people specialize in food production and other people specialize in clothing production? And one reason is, well, some people are just, if you just look at them, they would just be better farmers just from knowing their DNA. Some strapping people as opposed to like somebody who's in a wheelchair, it's going to be hard for that person to be a farmer, right? But that person could be sitting at a table and knitting or, whatever, depending on what the technology is, if you're on an assembly line making clothes, somehow putting buttons on shirts, I don't know what, but you get what I'm saying, that there's people, just their body types or whatever, there's one thing, a natural aptitude, but then also with practice, 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 but that's another consideration. So, there's all kinds of, it's not just their physical body, but also like their abilities, like, to say, why should we have some people specialize in being physicists and other people specialize in, I don't know what, fixing cars. And there there are physical care, you probably would have to have strong hands or something to be a good car mechanic, but also people's personalities, like you could just, tell, like some people don't like studying out of books. They hate that kind of learning. They want to, do something with their hands. And so that right there would be another reason that instead of forcing everyone to do an hour of physics a day, an hour of working on cars, let people just specialize. Okay, but beyond all that, there's also the issue of the distribution of natural resources around the globe. Okay, so if you say, why should we let some people specialize in bringing crude oil to market and other people specialize in bringing oranges to market? It's not merely that, some people, if you look at their body structure, they're more suited to digging oil wells than to climbing trees and picking oranges. You see what I'm saying? Like, for a huge consideration is, well, in some regions of the world, it's a lot easier to bring oil to the surface. And in other regions, it's just much more conducive to growing oranges. And so it's not about the people, it's about the area. And so you could, so in terms of the five things you listed, the only place that kind of consideration would fit in, I guess, would be natural aptitude, to say that some people, by virtue of where they were born, where they happen to be, have a much better advantage in terms of production of a certain commodity or service. So that would be another example, Malcolm. So like I say, off the top of my head, I don't remember if I talked about that in it or not, in the textbook or not. So there you go. Okay, Malcolm says, slavery could benefit from the law of association. The master and slave could benefit. Is that correct? Please note I'm not endorsing slavery. I'm speaking of economic consequences. I'm asking this due to Walter Block and the New York Times controversy about them misquoting him. Well, it depends what you mean. It depends what the baseline is, right? If you're saying, could we imagine somebody who was out in, and I should be real careful with this, I am not endorsing slavery. We're answering a very specific technical question just to shed light on the productivity of labor and division of labor. So It depends what you mean. Certainly, if we're holding all other things equal, and the question, does this guy right here is a slave, is he going to be better off remaining a slave or being free? The answer is, of course, no, free him, right? Because anything, like, even if for some reason it just so happened that where that particular human being belonged to the division of labor, like where his labor was the most productive and where he belonged, including his own preferences, like including his own willingness to work various types of occupation, depending on how much he was getting. So in other words, you know, you could theoretically imagine that a situation where, no, actually, you know, this guy, yeah, technically he's a slave and he doesn't have any choice in the matter, but what his master is having him do is exactly what he should be doing with his labor, talents, and whatever. And the compensation he's getting from the master, believe it or not, is exactly what he would, you know, what he should be getting. Like, that's the fair thing, you know, depending on whatever your criteria are for what should people receive in exchange for the work they contribute to society. Right, so it's a, you know, so you could, you know, you came up with some theoretical thing like that and said, so in that case, but then if you think markets work, you'd say, okay, but then what would happen is if the master freed that slave, they would end up doing the exact same thing except it would be voluntary. So the, you know, market forces would end up leading that same guy who before was a slave to now be a voluntary employee, and then the previous guy who was a master is now just the employer. And he says, if you do this particular work that I have in mind, I will give you all of these, you know, like, I'll maybe just give him money. Like this, the guy will go buy stuff that just so happens to be the exact combination of goods that the master previously provided with the benefit in kind to the slave. See what I'm saying? So there's that element that even if you, just for the sake of argument, came with a hypothetical situation to say, isn't it logically possible that someone who's technically a slave is nonetheless being assigned the exact right thing to do and being compensated in a way that actually he should prefer doing that than anything else that could happen? Well, that's what would happen in the free market. So even there, that's not an argument for slavery. Now, maybe what you mean, though, Malcolm, is, you know, could you imagine what if somebody's guy's on a ship and he gets shipwrecked and he's on a tropical island and it's just him at first and he's wandering around and he doesn't know how to fish. He's on the verge of starvation and, you know, his clothes are getting tattered. He gets caught in a rainstorm and he's sick and everything and he doesn't have any medicine and he's about to die. And then he stumbles upon some community of people who, you know, islanders, and they're different from him. You know, he's some white guy from the United States that stumbles onto their camp on the verge of death. And so they enslave him. But, you know, they're able to make food a lot easier than he is. And they actually have some kind of medicine that's, you know, good for people who are suffering from the cold or whatever, and so, you know, they nurse him back to health, but then he's their slave. You know, they don't let him leave, and, you know, force him to do work and so forth, but, you know, he would have died because just on his own in the harsh elements or whatever, with his limited skill set, you know, maybe he was a software engineer back in the United States, so he dropped this guy on the island, he's going to die if he's just left to his own devices. And so could you say he benefits from being enslaved by those people? Well, you don't know what he's mentally, you know, it's possible he values his freedom so much that he said, no, I wish I had died. You know, we don't know. So even there, you can't be sure. But if that's the kind of thing you have in mind, Malcolm, then yes, it is conceivable. You can imagine scenarios where an isolated free person has a really low standard of living precisely because individual human labor by itself is not very productive. And then it gets incorporated to a large social nexus, even if it's not a totally free society, and that person happens to be, you know, an indentured servant or worse yet, an outright slave. it's conceivable the person has a higher standard of living. But again, it's, you got to be careful. It's not just a matter of how many pieces of bacon do you get every breakfast. It's also, people might subjectively value their freedom a lot more than material things. Okay. Malcolm says, to be economically beneficial for the slave, the master just has to have the slave do something better than what he was doing before. For example, provide tools they didn't have before, utilizing technology, etc. Right, yeah, that's another way of looking at it. That, well, that would make it possible. That would make the slave's output higher. You know, so if the slave beforehand was not using a lot of tools or whatever, comes into an operation where the master gives the slave all kinds of equipment, then yes, that would augment the slave's productivity. But even that right there is not enough for us to conclude the slave's better off, because it depends how much of that output does he get to consume. Right? So it's possible that when he was free, yeah, his total output was real small, but he got to keep 100% of it. And then now when he's a slave, yeah, his output doubles. But if the, you know, if the master keeps 75% of it, then the slave consumption actually got cut in half. Okay. Other questions before I say something that's going to get me fired? Since you raised it, by all means, if you guys were logged in here live, if you have other questions, go ahead and fire them off. Let me just say something, though, that's, I think, interesting. The opponents of the market economy, really like to somehow paint it as if slavery is laissez-faire capitalism taken to the logical extreme. Right, they like to make it as, you know, all these people love to buy and sell things and treat everything as a commodity. And so in the extreme, that's what slave trade was, right? So, I mean, it's no surprise that Walter Block is in favor of slavery, right? Again, everyone, Walter Block is not in favor of slavery. I'm just trying to explain rhetorically the way interventionists will try to make it look as if they're the ones who are naturally and logically against slavery. And that the defenders of capitalism, yeah, they'll say they're against slavery, but actually you kind of don't believe them and you think they don't really care that much. And also the internal logic of their position should be for slavery, and the only reason they're against it is because for, you know, PR or just, you know, they're tender-hearted and don't have the courage to take their own views to their logical conclusion, right? So that's the argument you will hear a lot from people who don't like libertarians. They'll say, taken to its extreme, you know, your worship of markets and stuff, you should like the slave trade. Like, isn't that efficient? The price, you know, the price system allocates the slaves to their most high, you know, the best plantation. Da, 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 you idiots, right? That's the kind of charge you'll hear. That's totally wrong, right? It's actually, it took government intervention in markets to keep the slave trade alive. And to keep just the institution of slavery propped up. Now, you know, you can say, well, wait a minute, but didn't various governments ban the slave trade? Yeah, so ultimately that's what reversed it. But what I'm saying is normal market forces, precisely because of the stuff, well, yeah, precisely because of the stuff we're talking about here, would have led slavery to be overturned earlier had government not been propping it up. Mises talks a little bit about this in Human Action, and I'm trying to think if he's talked about it elsewhere. I mean, I'm sure he has. I just, off the top of my head, I can't think of where he has. But the way that I boiled it down is this. Okay, just empirically, you know, the countries that are freer do better in war. Right, so that gives you something to think about. Why was it in the American, what's called the Civil War, why is it, you know, if you study the military history of that, you'll see, oh, it's because, you know, how did the North win? Well, they fielded a bigger army and they had a navy and they could blockade the South. And, you know, it was just, it, you know, the South had to resort or should have resorted to guerrilla warfare, but they didn't. They tried to meet the Union Army on its own terms and fight like gentlemen on the open field and got slaughtered. But so ultimately, it was the North brought to bear more material. And the point is, that's not a coincidence. The North was based on free labor, and so that's why they were all industrialized, and that's why they could field a bigger army and had a whole navy to blockade the South. In other words, why didn't the South blockade the North, starve them into submission? And it's because the South was still largely based on slave labor, which is not productive. All right, so just think of it, so even so putting aside just the human tragedy of it and our national revulsion, slave labor is also very unproductive compared to free labor. And a main reason is, this is the way I kind of thought it through, that if you're the plantation owner and you have a bunch of slaves, how do you get them to work? You have to punish them, right? Otherwise, why would they work for you? And so what do you have to do? You have to set some kind of minimum standard and set, you know, say you hire some guy to, you know, with a whip or whatever, and you say, if they don't produce a certain amount, you got to whip them. Now, if you think it through, they actually can't be that tyrannical about it or that unreasonable. You know, they can't expect an 8-year-old boy to pick as much cotton or whatever it is they're doing as a 22-year-old young man. Right, and if they said no, we're just going to keep whipping them, make them do it. Well, that you would end up killing them, or you know, if you whip them every day, you're not going to be able to pick that much cotton anyway. Just like, you know, you own horses or something, you own other farm animals that help you on your plantation, and you wouldn't just keep physically abusing them day after day. That would be stupid. And besides being immoral, like, what are you doing? Leave those poor animals alone. It would be a stupid way to run a plantation. Okay, so again, it sounds crass and everything, but we need to be crass to show it's not mere considerations of human sympathy and whatever that makes slavery bad. It's also just out of own terms. It's a stupid system. It's inefficient that would not survive a genuine market with market forces. Let me be clear. I'm not just making a definitional move. I'm not just saying, oh no, in a free market, everyone owns his or her own body, and so therefore slavery is not a market thing. I mean, that's true, but that's not the point I'm making. I'm saying even if the government legally recognized property titles in other human beings, and that was the starting point, I'm saying that would not be a stable situation. It would evolve quickly into everybody owning him or herself. And the reason is because it's a horribly inefficient system to have slavery. Okay, so just to round out the train of thought, so, you know, you're the plantation owner and you have your, I don't know what you call them, managers or something, and they're the ones that actually mete out the punishments. So the way they have to do this, they have to set a fairly low threshold. And they could tailor it to different kinds of people. Like I said, they could have a different threshold for a 22-year-old young man who's healthy versus an 8-year-old boy versus, you know, a 16-year-old girl who's pregnant or something, you know what I mean? So someone's eight months pregnant, you can't expect her to do as much physical labor as somebody who's 22, right? Whatever it is they do, whatever their system is, I mean, they have to set a bare minimum and say, you get punished if you don't produce at least this much. And so that gives the incentives to all the slaves to just do the bare minimum to avoid punishment. Because it's not like they get anything extra if they produce above that quota. Okay, so because people are naturally different and they have different aptitudes and things like that, and some of them, if they really practiced at something, would get really good at it, okay, now the point is they don't have the intent to do that. Why should they go ahead and exert themselves? And so the point is that the slave system is extremely unproductive. It does not give human beings the opportunity or the incentive to flourish and develop their full potential. And so that is not merely a sad statement on the human condition. Oh, that's really awful from the slave's point of view, which it is, of course. And that's what everyone focuses on, you know, normal, tender-hearted people. That's the horror of slavery. But the point is, it's also not good just for the owner. You know, you have a bunch of really potentially productive factors of production on your property that you legally own, and yet the way you're treating them and managing them, you're only getting 5% of their potential out of them. Well, that's not a very efficient system. And so, you know, what if you think about, like, what could happen just in terms of normal business transactions, like one plantation owner could have this, could look around and see that this is going on, and then maybe he goes around to each of the plantations and he gives a speech to all the people, and he said, look, I know some of you actually can pick a lot more cotton, or can, you know, get more eggs from the chickens every day, or whatever it is that the job is you've been assigned. I know you could do a lot more, but you choose not to because this guy treats you like garbage, and, you know, why you just want to give him a better bottom line. You come work for me, and you volunteer, because we don't know who you are, but you know who you are. You step forward and volunteer. You come work at my plantation, and I have an arrangement here with your owner where I'm going to buy you off of him, right? And I'm going to give him a higher lump sum payment than what he's getting out of you now in terms of present discounted value, because he knows how much the person on his plantation produces and how much it's worth to him. Okay, so you come forward, and then you come over and work at my plantation for a trial period for a month or two, and I'm going to have you guys work double, you know, what the quota is here. You're not going to get whipped or anything if you don't meet the quota. It just means, you know, after 2 months, if you're just not meeting the double quota, we'll just bring you back here. You know, so it's a trial run. It's an arrangement I've got with your current owner. Okay, but if you do meet your quota, then, you know, I'm going to quadruple what is your living arrangement. You know, I'm going to give you a lot more, you know, than what you're getting right now from this guy. And like I said, there's no physical beatings or anything over there. People treat you with courtesy, but we're going to expect double the output of what you're doing right here. So he makes that speech and just goes around and gets, you know, 5 or 6 volunteers from everyone. So then he ends, you know, now he's running a plantation with all the best, most productive slaves, and they're cranking out, you know, they're producing at least double per capita what the other slave plantation group are. Right, so you can see what I'm saying, that just little things like that over time would eventually just mean, you know, they would say, look, it technically right now the law says I own you, and I could sell you to somebody for, well, I have no idea what slaves cost, $1,000. Okay, I know you can produce way more than you're producing for me right now, so I'll tell you what, I will lend you $1,000 at 20% interest, and then you work that, and then you're free, and then I'm going to hire you to work here, and you pay me off the loan, right? And so then, you know, the owner runs calculations and says, you know, I'll earn more than, right now I'm not earning a 20% return on my investment in this slave. If I lend him the money so that he can buy his freedom from me at 20%, I know he's going to have the ability to earn that in the market because he's very productive. And he's going to produce a lot more than he's producing for me as a slave. And so he'll have the means to then pay me off. See what I'm saying? So it's not fair. The slave shouldn't have to do that. But the point is, slavery is such a crazy system that the market would just chip away at it naturally over time. And if you say, oh, but Bob, Dr. Murphy, you don't call me Bob if you don't know. That didn't happen historically. What are you talking about? Nice little theory you just spun. Well, no, there were lots of laws against that sort of thing. It was illegal, for example, and I'll move on here. It was illegal in certain places to teach your slaves how to read. Think about that. So far from being the logical extreme of laissez-faire capitalism where, no, property rights are secure. No, clearly the law didn't say that those people owned the slaves and they could do whatever they wanted with. They weren't allowed to teach their own slaves how to read, at least in certain places. Right. And so you say, well, why did they? Because the rationale for that kind of prohibition was, yeah, we understand it's in your interest to educate your slaves so that, you know, you can, like, if the governess is going to raise your kid or something, you want her to be able to read the bedtime stories. Or if you're going to have a slave, you know, coming with you on business trips, you know, you want him to learn accounting or something. You know what I mean? Because that's what you need the slave to help you do. It's actually, you don't want to have a bunch of uneducated people on your staff, right? So it's, yeah, we know it's in your interest to educate them, but if all these slaves in our community start learning how to read and write and everything, they're going to start reading dangerous books and get crazy ideas in their head about being free. And so we're making it illegal. All right. So it's classic government, you know, making people operate against their own immediate interest in the pursuit of some alleged greater good that actually is horrible. All right. So that's, you know, I got to move on here. I don't get bogged down too much, but I'm trying to get you guys to see that the actual logic of free markets, so that would have quickly made slavery, you know, would have tamed the worst aspects of slavery, and then over time would have just led all of the slaves to buying their own freedom. So not even the government coming in and freeing them that way with tax dollars, like in terms of what, you know, the Joe Napolitano thing, if you saw John Stewart's hit piece on him recently, I'm not even talking about that. I'm saying just normal market mechanisms, somebody would have realized this is a crazy system. You got these people over here who would love to be free, and they're not, and you got these people over here who don't want them to be free because they paid good money for those slaves, when there's a third option here that makes them both better off, where the slaves get their freedom and then end up paying more to the owners than what their current market value is at the slave. Right? So that's what happens when there's inefficiency, when the factors of production are not producing as much output as they could. It means there's a way to rearrange things so that everybody ends up walking away with more. And so if you think slavery, so it's kind of funny, the people who think the market would support slavery, they actually have to be the ones to argue that slavery is an efficient system. That's what their position has to be. And you even saw that if you saw the John Stewart thing on the judge, where John Stewart and the, you know, senior black correspondent, or whatever they call that guy, they were the ones, they didn't dwell on it, but they actually had to say, no, that system would have lasted forever. And, you know, that because it was a viable system. They're the ones whose view of the world is such that, oh, yeah, if you enslave millions of people, that's the most productivity you're going to get out of it. So, I mean, that's actually pretty horribly offensive and insulting to the slaves if you think about it, to say that, yeah, the best anybody could ever hope for you is to be out in the field picking cotton and, you know, there's no other thing for you to be doing. And that's what their view has to be. And if their view is, well, no, if they were just given the opportunities or whatever, they could have flourished and become doctors and lawyers. And right, exactly. So that's why the system would not have lasted. If it really is, it would be like saying in a free market, a bunch of people could own horses and they would have them, you know, painting sketches of people. They'd, you know, be putting brushes in their mouth and trying to have the horse. And you say, what? That's crazy. That wouldn't happen. Or you'd have the horses on assembly lines cracking almonds or something to try to fill up bags of almonds that people don't have to, you know, I'm making up crazy stuff. But the point is, you know, think of something really dumb for horses to be doing that's not productive at all and doesn't take account of their full potential. And then ask yourself, could that last in a system where human beings own horses? And the answer is no, of course not. That's stupid. All right. I'm done ranting now. Okay, Steven says, and he's one lecture behind, okay, so I've always been confused about paper indices for gold and other commodities. Take gold, for example. Would the value of a paper index always gain and fall equal to physical gold in the long run? Steven, can you clarify? I don't know exactly what you're asking. So can you clarify that? Malcolm, in the meantime, Malcolm says, has anyone written on the factors that allow for fractional reserve banking, central banking system to continue? Are there factors which will cause the eventual collapse? Yeah, I mean, let me just point you to, what is it called? If you just Google Malcolm, Hoppe, Salerno, and Hulsman, fraction reserve banking. I think you'll find there was a series of articles. I think it was in the Quarterly Journal of Austrian Economics where they were going back and forth with Selgin and White. And the Selgin and White piece is something like, we are not Devo, we are Sexiness. Okay, and they're making a play on words about, you know, Devo the band. Okay, so if you Google those, you'll find one of the articles, and then that should give you a bunch of citations you can, you know, then get your bearings. So that's where I would point you to see what the literature is, and then there's all kinds of sites you can take that as far as you want. Okay, back to Stephen. He says, it seems if commodities are a hedge, a paper commodity would not be. I may be using the wrong terminology. Gold ETF. Okay, yeah. So I think what you're saying, Stephen, is, like, let's say you wanted to get into gold as a hedge against price inflation. And what about a derivative based on that that's not the actual underlying commodity itself? So like a gold ETF, where technically what you, the investor, are buying is not ownership of physical gold, but rather you're buying shares of corporate stock in an ETF, which stands for exchange traded fund, and then in principle the ETF is supposed to be out there in the market buying and selling either physical gold or claims to physical gold, so that in theory the ETF stock price should be moving proportionally to the price of the commodity, such that it's just an easier way. And it's also for people who have tax qualified plans and things that for some people I know who are retired and they have 401ks, and then, you know, I convinced them that about the dangers of price inflation, but they didn't want to have to take their money out and get a huge tax bill so they could go buy actual gold. And, you know, and the rules of their 401k, they weren't allowed to literally own gold. But what they could do is they could invest in a gold ETF or a broader, you know, commodity index kind of deal. So the advantages of it, Stephen, are that it's a lot more convenient for certain people, depending on the institutional structure, to, you know, sell down their shares in certain stocks and then increase their ownership of other, what strictly speaking are shares of stock. It just so happens to be that the company in which they're now owners is dedicated just to maintaining reserves of gold or silver or whatever. The downside, though, is, okay, one thing, Stephen, you're right, they don't track perfectly. In fact, when I was working in the financial sector as an employee at a firm, that's, you know, the boss had a very particular view of what was going to happen with oil prices, and I convinced people, well, gee, you know, if the boss thinks that, we should adjust our portfolio. Look, there's these oil ETFs, you know, because they were thinking, well, you know, what are we going to do? We can't just acquire physical barrels of crude oil with that. But I, you know, there's these things called oil ETFs, and it's priced. And so we took a position, and what was ironically, the boss was actually wrong, at least in the short run. But fortunately for me, in terms of my job, the ETF went the wrong way, right? It was like oil prices went up, but the ETF went down for some reason. And so we actually, we had shorted it because he thought oil prices were going to go down. So we actually benefited, but just because the index didn't work right. You know what I mean? So, like, fortunately, I didn't get in as much trouble if it had been the other way around. Okay, so, yeah, there's issues like that, Stephen, where it doesn't track. And then more, especially if you're talking about gold, silver, the danger is, or the fear is, well, if these are real big institutions on Wall Street, for all we know, they're actually, you know, the plunge protection team has paid them a visit. And maybe if the administration thinks the gold price is too high, they get the exchange traded fund to sell its physical holdings into the market to knock the price down. And that, you know, if you want to withdraw your gold or something, that the government will just say, oh, well, no, in the interest of quelling the financial panic, we're going to suspend all these transactions. Da, 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 da. So a lot of people will say, look, if you want to get into gold as a hedge against price inflation, get the actual physical thing, like get physical ownership of it. Ideally in your own possession, not that it's being held by some third party on your behalf, because for all you know, they're actually not going to have it for you when you need it. The kind of scenario where you'd really be glad you had gotten into gold is when the dollar crashes, it's Mad Max. And so in that kind of scenario, the argument goes, you want your physical gold buried in your backyard or whatever. You don't want it to be a piece of paper you have or a screenshot of some firm in Wall Street saying how much gold they're holding for you. Do you think you're going to see it under those circumstances? Okay, I will stop there, and thanks everyone for tuning in, and I will blast out the announcement about the exam once posted.